You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
Yeah, it's been a huge year for me, you know, winning E3 and such a great tour, getting married, honeymoon, book coming out and everything. But I think the highlight has to be winning a podcast Pedaleur des Champs award, for sure. That T-shirt, it's pride of place in my wardrobe.
This is only the beginning. You can't even imagine what we are going to do for the future.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, Lionel.
Confused you there by looking at you, Lionel, and saying Daniel's name. Did you like that?
That's fine.
Okay, so we're third podcast of 2016, and let's kick off. There's been lots happening, lots to talk about. So let's kick off with your weekly roundup, Lionel.
Yeah, busy week. Just rattle through the news, shall we? The UCI World Cyclocross Championships were held in the mud adjacent to the Zolder motor racing circuit in Belgium. The big story, of course, which we'll talk about a bit more in the episode, is that an under-23 Belgian woman, Femke van der Driessche, was caught with a suspected motor in her bike, or some kind of cheating device in her bike. We will shed a bit more light on that, hopefully, or possibly. We'll talk our way around that in later on in the podcast. And that did rather overshadow Evie Richards' victory in the inaugural women's under-23 title race. That's the first time that event's been held at the World Cyclocross Championships. In the men's under-23 race, there was another sort of controversial moment when Adam Tupalik of the Czech Republic celebrated victory a lap too early and then got out-sprinted by Belgian Eli Isabit in the finishing sprint. So a bit of an unfortunate race for him. The following day, the women's race was won by Thalita de Jong of the Netherlands. And in the men's elite race, Belgian Wout van Aert won his first world title, beating Lars van der Haar in a thrilling final lap. Dutch and Belgian riders filled the first eight places, and the race was slightly soured by van der Haar's allegations that he was doused with beer and urine thrown by presumably Belgian spectators who were rooting for a Belgian win and got their way.
Well, cyclocross sounds like a lovely sport.
Normally it is. Normally it is. You know, normally they don't throw urine and beer at people. But
I mean, it was pretty obvious. Anthony McCrossan in the UCI commentary made repeated references to the boo. You could hear the boos and the treatment the Dutch riders were getting throughout. And he made the, you know, there were significant gaps between races, lots of time for drinking. So perhaps that played its part.
Well, yeah. I mean, funnily enough, I was going to say Sven Nys brought down the curtain on a glorious career. He won the World Cup Series six times, two world titles. Little known fact, but I was appointed president of the British wing of the Sven Nys fan club a few years ago after a trip with the Belgian fan club of Sven Nys to the World Cup at Kopseeder.
Is that a very active branch of the Sven Nys fan club, Lionel?
Not terribly active these days. I do have a membership card.
You haven't been a very effective president then, have you?
No, not really. No, I haven't recruited many people.
And now it's too late.
We're venturing into Justin Rose territory.
But the point here is that I travelled with this group of increasingly drunken Belgian fans. A coach load of them travelled from Baal, which is Nys's hometown, out to Kopseeder, which is up on the coast. And they were pretty well oiled by the time we even arrived at the circuit. And I was talking to them about the atmosphere and the fact that, you know, they do cheer in a very sort of fervent way. And one of them said, you know, we cheer for Sven, but we don't boo other people. Mm. And it's very frowned upon in that group, certainly, to boo any of Sven's rivals. So, you know, honour among the cyclocross fans, but perhaps not in evidence at the weekend. Meanwhile, on the road, the Challenge Mallorca, Andre Greipel won two bunch sprints there, and the other stages won by Gianluca Brambilla and Fabian Cancellara. Down under, still racing going on. The Cadel Evans Great Ocean Race saw a solo win for the British champion Peter Kennick. Amanda Spratt won the women's race there. I think all past Tour de France champions should have a race named after them. You know, the Bradley Wiggins Classic.
It would be a 10-mile time trial, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
In Hull.
Yeah.
What about the controversial Lance Armstrong?
That'd be a round of golf.
No holds barred. You're allowed to do what you like. Take what you like for that. Pete Kennock really didn't honour the great man, did he, by attacking to win? You know,
Hey, one of Cadel Evans' greatest victories was a spectacular attack to win the World Road Race Championship in 2010, wasn't it?
Nine.
Was it nine?
From injuries, yeah.
Indeed.
I think you're right.
Indeed. Yeah. In the south of France, Dries De Venins won the Grand Prix La Marseillaise, pipping Thibaut Pinot. And we've just heard that the 2018 World Road Race Championships have been awarded to Innsbruck in Austria. The first time they'll be held in Austria since Villach in 1987, when Stephen Roach won.
Wrong, Lionel. Yeah? Wrong, Lionel. 2006, Salzburg.
We could cut that out, but we won't. Anyway, that is a very full and comprehensive roundup. It does make you think, doesn't it? We're just into February, mm-hmm. and there's all this stuff going on.
We've got to keep this pace up until November.
And we're looking at the schedule, you know, for coming up, and it's really kicking off. We're going to be announcing our new partnership with Eurosport. They were partners last year, and we're delighted that they are joining us again this year. We'll tell you what's coming up on Eurosport, and it's a lot.
There's so much racing. It's very exciting.
Oh, God.
You want the red card.
So, did you watch cyclocross, Lionel?
I did.
It was
the wonders of the internet.
Yeah, it was a thrilling, some thrilling racing, and you know the atmosphere is phenomenal. It's like a cross between, I don't know, a ski race and a bullfight or something. It's very, as I say, fervent fans there, and that is seemed yesterday to be tip or on Sunday to be tipping over into something a little bit uglier. And you wonder if, you know, we know what happened at the Tour de France last year, what was alleged to have happened. Well, or it did happen. We saw Chris Froome being spat at, certainly. We heard of riders being punched. It's a nasty little element creeping into the roadside support at some races.
Mm. Well, we talked about this on the tour, didn't we? And we're debating whether or not to debate the wider issue. And the problem is that, you know, copycat type effect takes hold, doesn't it? And then, you know, what kind of, it's almost tolerated in one place, then takes off somewhere
else.
Maybe
we're guilty of not being entirely honest about the past. I mean, Bernardino used to talk about the treatment he got in Belgium. He complained that he had beer thrown at him and telephone directories, which is a very odd method of attack.
We're in danger of twanging cycling's hysteria nerve, which is very well worn with this issue as well, because I think, yeah, it's always been part of cyclocross. The tribalism of cyclocross is something which, in all seriousness, distinguishes it from road cycling in an interesting way, an intriguing way. I mean, for better or for worse, in road cycling, fans tend to just support all the riders. You know, you do get tribal elements, but the tribal element is something that's very present in cyclocross. And one of the reasons why I think it's gaining in popularity and is such a good spectacle. Obviously, you know, there are unsavory elements that need to be controlled.
What gives football its magic is the tribalism and the electricity that's generated sometimes,
and the hostility.
Poisonous. The hostility, it's poisonous. The more poisonous it is, the greater the atmosphere. You know, and in cyclocross as well, you need that sort of edge to it. But certainly when it as Lars van der Haar said, that you know, he had beer thrown at him, and we hope it was beer, but you know, that sort of booing is one thing.
He's fairly clear that urine was thrown at him.
So booing is one thing, but having urine thrown at you or being punched at something is something else entirely.
Yeah, I think it's fairly clear where the line is there, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? My friends in the Sven Nys fan club would say we support our man, and you know, we don't give too much grief.
What
to
about your friends
rivals
in the British branch of the Sven Nys fan club? How many of those are there? I mean, well, if we're going to have a very kind of gentle, non-tribal version of cyclocross, I think we bring along the British branch of the Sven Nys fan club.
Absolutely. Well, why not? I mean, let's invent a new way of watching cyclocross. We'll pop along with strawberries and cream, a bit like Wimbledon, you know, sort of bottle of Carver maybe.
So anyway, talking of the line, you did mention the alleged motorized doping. Did we call it alleged? I mean, the UCI have come out and said it is a clear cut case of motorized doping. They've been looking for motors and bikes since 2010. Really, when Fabian Cancellara won Paris-Roubaix that year, well, he won Tour Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, and there were claims made that, you know, his victories were so so dominant that he must have had a motor in his bike. It was treated as a joke at first, then slowly people began to take it seriously as more and more experts came out and said, well, actually the technology does exist, it is possible. And 2010 Tour de France, I think, was the first time the UCI were there checking bikes for motors. Cancellara, I remember, was asked about the rumours. He said, the only motor is my legs. But they've never found, you know, they've been looking ever since then for motors and bikes, never found anything. This is the first time it's happened. Quite a watershed.
A big moment, yeah. But as soon as I heard this had come to light, I just thought back to the number of times Greg LeMond has sort of tried to convince me that this, not that the technology exists, because I think we all accept the technology exists, but he was adamant when I spoke to him at the start of last year that it had been used in races, and that, you know, he was saying, look, I've got one of these bikes at home, I ride it, you know, it gives me however many watts in it. And that's, I think that's the thing about it. It doesn't need to give many watts to be a huge advantage. 20, 40, 60 watts, you know, used cleverly and carefully, completely could distort the outcome of a race. So, you know, the technology's there. They've been looking for it. In a way, it's kind of surprising it's taken this long to uncover something. And clearly, you know, we don't know the full story yet, but it's a bit of a strange one, that, you know, why... If you're going to use it, you know, you've got to do everything possible to conceal its use, and presumably some kind of logistical mistake has happened.
Yeah, I mean, in cyclocross, maybe the opportunities are there with the bike changes in the pits, and so maybe there's a greater possibility to do something, and perhaps there was some kind of mess up. I did imagine, perhaps naively, that if and when somebody was caught, that there would be no hiding place. You couldn't come out with any kind of dog ate my homework type excuse. But lo and behold, that's what's happened. And in this case, she claims that the bike belonged to, the bike was hers. She sold it to a friend, and the friend had obviously installed a motor. That bike suddenly ends up back in her, you know, in the pits for her to use at the World Championships. It's with exactly the same position and everything else. It seems slightly far-fetched to me.
Yeah, it sounded like a fairly carefully constructed alibi, right down to the fact that there were the girl in question's initials were engraved, or that there was a sticker with her initials on the bike. So that obviously made it slightly difficult to claim that it didn't belong to her, hadn't belonged to her. So she came up with the, well, excuse or explanation that it had been her bike, but she sold it. And, you know, there's a bit of background intrigue as well involving her father. He appeared on Sports yesterday in the Belgian television network in they did, I think, the only interview with Femke van den Driessen. And the father was there. He answered questions, and we subsequently learned that he's facing charges or allegations of stealing canaries from pet shops in Belgium. Yeah, it's a classic cycling story. You really couldn't make it up, could you? A brother is serving a doping ban. Quintessentially Belgian. Quintessentially, you know,
cycling. Quintessentially cycling.
The canary in the coal mine. Story. Not in this case. It was canary the canary from the pet shop.
Well, it's happened. So, you know, and it's the kind of story that gets picked up by the mainstream media. You know, doesn't really matter the identity of the culprit. It could have been any race, could have been any rider. As soon as this happened, she's a pro cyclist, you know, motorized doping, a motor found in the bike of a pro cyclist. That's a headline that will appear in BBC, New York Times, around the world. And of course, people jump to the conclusion that it's a widespread problem, and I think we've always wondered whether it is. I think there's a big suspicion in Italy that it's a big problem in perhaps Gran Fondo type races.
Yeah, I mean, what is fortunate about this problem that has been uncovered is that it should be fairly easy to detect, certainly at the highest level. It should be fairly easy to implement controls at world tour level, even, you know, top races involving pro continental teams, it will be more difficult in amateur racing. And, you know, you might say, well, what's the incentive of doing it in amateur races where not a lot is at stake? You could make the same argument for an under-23 women's cyclocross race. I mean, very, very best case scenario, you make it to the very, very top of that particular domain, women's cyclocross, and you know, the prizes involved are a few hundred euros for super prestige races, World Cup races, 5,000 euros for the overall women of overall winner of the women's super prestige, which is their season-long showcase. So, you know, not an awful lot to gain. But then, going back to what we said earlier about the fervour surrounding cycling and cyclocross, particularly in Belgium, and then you add in elements like family members who are keen to see their children's names up in lights, and you know, people
well,
do resort to
if she wanted fame, she's got it, hasn't she?
Has,
so
yeah.
that's certainly an accomplishment. And you know, she's 19 years old. There's clearly an entourage around her. She's not done this on her own. It's the first case. I think the rules allow for a minimum of a 6-month ban. Quite big fines as well. Big financial penalties. You know, it could go up to a lifetime ban. I don't know if that's, you know, does it come under the WADA code, or I'm not really sure about that, or whether this is a thing that the UCI.
There's a separate article in the UCI regulations which alludes not specifically to motorized doping, but to gaining an unfair
fraud
or gaining an unfair advantage.
So this is a clear cut case of cheating, but you know, Femke van den Dries shouldn't be the only person to be punished as a result of this if the case is proven, should she?
Well, no. If anyone else has been in on it, then you know they should have no place in the sport either. But I mean, what are the wider implications for this? You know, other than a kind of a dent to cycling's credibility. You mentioned the sort of the mainstream coverage of it, and it is the tone of some of the articles has been, look at what these crazy cyclists will do to try and get an edge, you know, now. And I think there's an element of it just undermines the whole sport, doesn't it? But to be fair to the UCI, they have been looking for this. You know, they have been scanning bikes,
and
I think 5 or 6 years now.
And there, you know, there's been a bit of mockery about that. And fair play, they have. You know, they brought in the testing in 2010 under the previous president Pat McQuaid, and they have. It's certainly not something they've shied away from. They found something now, and that has got to, you know, we've always thought how, you know, if they are testing, the risks are surely far too great. You know, the chances of being caught must be reasonable to high. So,
another couple of positive take-homes I would suggest. One is that I think this is a good example. It could prove to be a good example of a peloton or a group of riders policing themselves, because I think everything points in this case towards a tip-off. The rider in question, Femke van den Dries, rode very, very dominantly a few weeks ago, at the Koppenberg Cross. Mm-hmm. In a manner really that rang all sorts of alarm bells. You know, she went away from the field, put about 10 seconds into them on the Koppenberg, or part of the Koppenberg, isn't it, they ride in that cross race. And it looks as though eyebrows were raised then. Someone maybe had a word with someone at the Federation or the UCI, and the test came about for that reason. Another positive that we can take from this is that if people are thinking about putting motors in their bikes, etc., that is also partly because the doping window of opportunity has closed slightly. You know, there was no reason to even contemplate something like this in the mid-1990s because, you know, the advantages of EPO were 10%.
Although, again,
10-15%.
If you listen to Greg LeMond.
Well, yeah, exactly. But, you know, if people are now looking for slightly... very, very risky, slightly ridiculous means to gain an advantage rather than the old chemical avenues, then at least that reflects fairly well on the work the sport has done to clean itself up.
Become a friend of the podcast for 2016. For £10, you'll have access to our Friends Specials, 11 in-depth episodes that will take you even further inside the sport. All our Friends Specials are now available on your mobile device. Our 2015 Friends Specials are also still available for £5. To sign up, visit www.thecyclingpodcast.com.
So I mentioned that Eurosport have come back to support the Cycling Podcast this year. Thank you very much. They partnered with us last year Throughout the year, especially at the Tour de France, where we did our daily Pedaleur de Charme award, and that was sponsored by Eurosport, and we'll be doing other similar type initiatives with Eurosport this year, I think, at the Giro and at the Tour. So thank you very much to them, and their coverage is really kicking off about now, this week in particular, the Dubai Tour and the Valencia Tour, both live on Eurosport, and other things like Behind the Stripes, a documentary following the Trek team will be playing, and that's available on Eurosport, also on the Eurosport player. So lots of coverage on Eurosport, the home of cycling. And there's already been, you mentioned in your roundup, Lionel, that there's already been quite a lot of racing. Peter Kennick once again showed that when he's given the chance, he's pretty good at taking it. The question is, how many more chances will he be given? Remember, we spoke last year about the possibility of him leaving Sky for BMC, maybe another team where he might get a few more chances, but you can see him, you know, being given opportunities in races like the Cadel Evans race, which, let's face it, in the grand scheme of things, doesn't really matter a great deal, but he wins it very, very impressively. But when it comes to the bigger races, he's going to be required to perform a team role, isn't he?
I would have thought so, yeah. I don't think, the Sky pecking order with the signing of Lander has pushed him down another place, really. It's a bit like
Kwiatkowski as well. We always thought of Kennick for the Ardennes classics. Mm.
I think the Cadel Evans Ocean Race, is that what we call it?
Great Ocean Race.
Was a good example of what we've mentioned in the past about the development of young riders at Sky. Afterwards, Kenyuk talked about how he has tended to make the same mistake again and again and again of attacking too early. And that is the kind of thing that you would imagine a rider could have kind of ironed out if they have that problem over the course of a few seasons of being thrust into a position of responsibility, having to lead a team again and again and again. That's the kind of mistake that they would be expected to correct. In his case, he hasn't had that much experience of leading the team.
Of attacking early, remember the Commonwealth Games road race he took off on the first lap with Mark Cavendish in the team car.
I was about to say, I think he's had a fairly suspect director's sportive.
You could have seen them arguing. I don't know what was said. It'd been great to have been a fly on the wall there.
But without spoiling a comment Daniel made in our forthcoming Friends of the Podcast special about the history of the HTC High Road team, Daniel, you mentioned about Telecom back in the day when they were the big super team. You know, riders that were in that team would be promised that they'd float further towards the top of the list, and then they'd just buy in expensive talent. And that's really Sky, you know, they're not the only ones. Etix, Quickstep are the same. You know, that's the model. It's a bit like, I don't want to use a football analogy, but, you know, it's very difficult to get off the bench.
Absolutely not. And it happens again and again with Sky, and it makes you wonder about the kind of conversations they have with riders and their agents prior to recruiting them. You know, you can mention any number of riders there. Leopold Kony, Nicholas Roach, these are the guys who were just signed last year. Kenyuk, you know, with regard to Kwiatkowski arriving this year, you know, presumably at some point all of those guys thought, you know, there's a chance here that I might get a leadership role in a major race. And then the big signing arrives, and I don't imagine that's terribly motivating.
Kenyuk is a feisty young, still call him young, he's not even that young anymore, really. He's heading towards, you know, mid-late 20s, but he is ambition oozing from every pore, doesn't he? And he's somebody who does appear to be desperate for his chance. Interestingly, he said it was Luke Rowe who urged him not to attack when he wanted to attack and to exercise some caution. He's a rare example of a young rider who's developed really well at Team Sky and has graduated to a leadership stroke captain.
Yeah, and I think the Flatter Classics is an area where there are opportunities at Sky, that there has been a bit of a void there, whether that's because it doesn't quite float Sir Dave Brailsford's boat or those races in the same way that the Grand Tours, those seem to be the races that really excite him, the Grand Tours. But if they are given slightly less attention, those classics, it also means that, you know, there are chances there for people to emerge and take on leadership roles. It's kind of happened with Stannard. No one would have predicted necessarily at the start of Stannard's career that he was going to be a major force in those races. The same is happening with Rowe. So I think that's where there is room for young riders there.
Let's turn our attention to Majorca as well, where the Challenge Mallorca is very much has the vibe of a training race. It's a stage race, but you don't have to ride every stage. It's sort of a pick and mix race for riders with good field in Mallorca. As you say, Lionel, couple stage wins for Andre Greipel. But the real highlight, I think, for a lot of people was Fabian Cancellara's solo victory on one of the toughest stages over a lot of climbs. It'll be very familiar to anybody who's ridden in Mallorca. To some of us who've ridden in Mallorca, those are like alpine climbs, and see Cancellara taking off and winning on roads like that was quite a surprise in a way. But it was January. Anyway, it's his last season, and towards the end of last year, when I was in the Basque Country, I spoke to Markel Irizar, who's been his domestique for a few years at Trek now. And Irizar was interesting talking about Cancellara and what he's like at training camps and in the winter and so on, and what he's like as a team leader. So let's hear from Irizar now. What's Cancellara like? I mean, what's he been like? You've obviously trained with him, raced with him. He's been the most consistent classics rider for the last almost decade. What makes him special? I mean, you see him working on training camp. Is it the amount he works, or is it just his sheer talent?
I think that both things. I mean, he's really strong rider. I mean, you can see since he was really young that his level is super. You know, he was, I think, 2 times junior champion already. You know, world champion in the TT. But also he works a lot. You know, he goes to Gran Canaria beginning from December, and then he's really constant. You know. And of course, I think one of the things that he's able to handle the pressure, you know, because these riders, I mean, all the big riders, they have a big pressure. And sometimes this is the difference between the good riders and the super big champions, you know, the way that they are able to handle and to keep the pressure. And, you know, like, I think that this is not easy, you know, when you know that, for example, now when he's out, I mean, the team, when Fabian is out, our team, you know, we have really big problems, you know. So I think that for him, it can be easy, you know, to know that 70 families almost depend on what you are doing on the road, you know. So
yeah, and especially because he has been such a huge figurehead for the team. Is he somebody who on training camps, you know, in the south of Spain in December, is he ripping everyone's legs off there? Is he doing double sessions? What is his condition always that much better than everybody else's?
No, for this in the training camps he's really quiet. He's not the kind of rider that he makes exhibitions training or you know, he, no, for this he's really quiet. He always tries to go quiet, and he says, hey, we need to make the shows in the races, not in the training, you know. So for this it's really easy. And for example, we train in 2 groups, the classic groups and the Grand Tours group. And of course, I'm in the classic group, and it's super good that Fabian is there, because nobody attacks and we go really smooth. And for this, it's really, really good, you know, really good.
But it's actually easier if he's in the group.
Yeah, he's, and then nobody attacks when he's there. Everybody knows that he doesn't like to make stupid things. So everybody goes, I mean, pretty, not serious, but you know, like, we do what we need to do, and we don't start doing stupid things, you know.
And in the races itself, when it comes to, you know, the day of Flanders, day of Roubaix, what's he like? Is he very calm? Is he very good at putting you all at ease and telling you what your jobs are?
Yeah, of course. Normally we do a meeting the day before, and then Dirk talks. That Dirk and Luca, I mean the manager and the director, they talk. They say what is going to be the tactic, and then he says what he thinks, you know. More or less we have a system, let's say, like the way of working, you know, like each one has his own role. Normally, I used to start, the first one to pull were me and Jesse Sargent, so, and then we have like order, and this we never change, so we don't need to talk about this, for example. But he says what, how he sees the race and how he feels and all the stuff. And then in the race, yeah, you can feel, I mean, when he's the on, for example, normally in Flanders and in Roubaix, in the first case, he used to be pretty relaxed, you know. We are doing our job and he used to be relaxed. But you think that he's relaxed, but when, I don't know, when a group is going straight away, from he says from the radio, okay, guys, we need to close this group, you know. So he's like, I mean, you need to be like a big rider, but also a big champion, you know, big leader. He is a big leader for
us. He's always paying attention.
Of course, I mean, of course, because if we make a mistake, I mean, we are going to pay really expensive, you know. So that's why... he's really paying attention to everything, the tires, and with the bikes, with the clothing, and with everything.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. J Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
So we heard there from Marc Alizar Domestique at Trek Segafredo, and he's been a teammate Cancellara's for a few years. But he was talking about having ridden with Cancellara and looking ahead to his final year. He will be determined to get, you know, to go out on a high. Cancellara, Spartacus, he's got a real strong sense, I think, of his own legacy and mythology, hasn't he? He's not going to want to go out with a whimper. He wants to go out winning another Flanders or a Roubaix.
Yeah, win another Cobble Classic. The Tour de France goes to his home city, Bern, and the World Championships in Doha. You know, you wouldn't rule him out from being one of the big contenders there. I mean, if he were to win the world title, which, you know, could happen, would he retire, would he bow out, or would he carry on one more year? You'd have to, you know, although it is his last season, if he won the world title, surely he'd wear the rainbow jersey and do one more year.
Yeah, you'd think a rider like him might be one of those riders who just carries on to the Spring Classics and bows out then, as I think Tom Bonin might do eventually.
Just realised, you know, that was incredible speculation from me there. Very unlike me to look to at the end of the season
extraordinary
and predict, you know, like needle in a haystack stuff, isn't it? But it's a big year for the last, you know, for the two giants of the Cobble Classics, isn't it?
Cancellara had an absolute nightmare last year, and you don't want to read too much into a race in Mallorca in January, but it was quite an impressive performance. It suggests that he's worked hard over the winter and he's in decent shape.
Yeah, and he's spoken quite a lot over the last few months about wanting to enjoy what time he has left in professional cycling and not putting too much pressure on himself. I also think his team, Trek Segafredo, has had a... Well, in previous years, certainly last year, they've had a bit of a beleaguered air at times. Certainly a huge amount of their, or a huge proportion of their resources have gone into Cancellara himself, in just in terms of wages, but also in terms of objectives and what they hope to achieve in the season. I think this year they're looking slightly better balanced. They've taken on some new riders. Bonifazio's there, who's come from Lamprey. And Ryder Heyerdahl's gone there, and you know, people have taken their eye off Cancellara a little bit because he was out for a lot of last season. Might be a bit less pressure. New riders have emerged in the classic, so the focus won't be as squarely on him and Boonen as it has been at times in the past. So it could all be set up quite nicely for a glorious swan song.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/TCP to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
Yeah, you heard our longer Trainer Road jingle there. Trainer Road training continues. We've moved on to a different program, Lionel. I don't know about you, but I'm finding it pretty hard going.
Yeah, it is. It's all sprint efforts now, isn't it? And high intensity and... much, much longer as well. An hour and three quarters on the turbo trainer. That's, I can see Daniel glazing over and shrugging.
Yeah, my legs are very sore, I have to say. But, you know, we stick at it. Yeah. We've got another call with Coach Chad coming up, and we'll be producing a Kilometre Zero on Trainer Road, our Trainer Road training very soon, which will be full of practical tips for all the cyclists out there, like Daniel. So... apart from our own training, the actual racing is continuing. And we didn't mention the Sun Tour earlier, but Chris Froome is making his start to the season there. And a few other big names, Daniel, that we'll see over the coming days and weeks.
Yeah, we've got Daniel Martin in Valenciana. So he's riding there. Fabio Aru making his season debut. Of course, a season in which Aru is going to be targeting the Tour de France. Mm-hmm. He's going to be the captain there for Astana. Bit of news, actually, on Astana and their other team leader, Vincenzo Nibali. It's looking more and more likely that he won't be there in 2017, Nibali. Lamprey are very, very confident of signing Nibali next year. I'm sure there are probably other teams involved. There's been talk over the last few months about Nibali's manager, Alex Carrera, even trying to set up his own team, possibly with backing from the Gulf States, or one of the Gulf States. I'm not sure how that's progressing or if it's even progressing at all. But going back to Lamprey, they they think they can get Nibali. They don't expect to be able to offer as much as Astana, but the general feeling around Nibali is that he's desperate to, or he's very keen to leave Astana. Not particularly enamoured with the way decisions are made there. Tend to be made by committee. Alexander Vinokurov, of course, has a big influence on most decisions, but there are others involved as well. And the one sticking point with Lamprey, as well as the money, although that might not be the problem that you would expect, because Nibali, by all accounts, is not terribly motivated by earning a huge final pay packet. He's more,
and he'll not be bad anyway. I mean, whatever he's
no, doing. And he's. I think he's. Well, certainly what he's told people in his entourage, he's more concerned with being in an environment that he wants to race in. The main sticking point could be staff, the staff that he wants to bring from Astana. And I think he would particularly like to bring his coach, Paolo Slongo, with him from Astana. However, Lamprey have their own structures. Michele Bartoli, the former Classics maestro of the 1990s, is a coach there. They also have agreements with a medical centre in Lecco that seems to be working pretty well at the moment. So they don't really want to upset that too much, and they might have to find some kind of compromise with Nibali as far as Slongo is concerned.
So Nibali's going to ride the Giro?
Yeah, Nibali's riding the Giro, but he'll probably ride the Tour as well. He said he wants to ride the Tour as well, but Rio is a big target for him. The Olympic road race. He says he'd go to the Tour and help Fabio Aru, which is a tantalizing prospect, isn't
that's
it?
Excellent. That'd be really good.
Yeah, that'd be really good fun if that happened. But he's got to be the favourite at the Giro, I think. Nibali. Certainly, when I asked Mikel Landa a few weeks ago at the Team Sky training camp, he's riding the Giro as well. You know, for him, he said Nibali is the big favourite, and he obviously knows him very well, having ridden at Astana with him. Anything else this week, chaps? Any other speculation, gossip, Daniel?
Another small bit of gossip. Sunday was the opening race in the French calendar this year, the GP La Marseillaise. Famed, infamous for its curse, the curse that is visited upon winners of that race. An assortment of misfortunes has struck winners of that race in the past. Thibaut Pinot narrowly avoided that by finishing second. The GP La Marseillaise nowadays, or as of a course change this year, finishes with quite a fiddly little descent. Pinot, by all accounts, looks okay on there. Possibly because he's been working again on his descending this winter. I know that Oscar Saez, who we've mentioned in the podcast before, one of professional cycling's only or rare descending gurus, he visited FDJ at their training camp in Calpe this winter.
Yeah, he's a former mountain biker, and he had previously made an approach to FDJ and Pinot via you, Daniel. Wow. And they turned him down. So
they weren't able to work with him then because he was affiliated with Giant.
Or was it Lotto Jumbo?
His affiliation in the past has been with Giant, right? And who was sponsoring Lotto Jumbo at the time. And then
Belkin, I think, or whoever it was at the time. Blanco, maybe. Yeah.
But he certainly spent at least one day with FDJ on their camp, did all sorts of drills, and gave them various types of advice about descending.
He's fascinating. Speaking to him about the art of descending is really interesting. The difference between descending on a mountain bike and a road bike is really interesting, because mountain bikers, downhill mountain bikers especially, study the course in advance. They know how to ride it. They really think about how to ride it, whereas road riders, you know, are just plunged down descents that they might not even know. There has been a bit of speculation about Pinot's future, because I think he's out of contract end of this year. Is that just a bit of gamesmanship?
Well, I think, you know, he has said publicly that he's keeping his options open, but of course he's going to say that. I mean, that's sort
aren't
of...
Aren't we all?
Well, it's negotiation, it's contract negotiation, chapter one, isn't it?
Because FDJ are confirmed they're in to the end of 2018 now.
Yeah, and his one concern, I think, is the support that he's going to get in major tours in particular. That's been a problem in the past, but they, with every year over the past couple of seasons, they've added new riders. Steve Morabito came on board 2 years, or the start of last year. This year they've got another Swiss rider, French-speaking Swiss rider, Rettenbach, who's come from IAM Cycling. So They're slowly putting the pieces together of what should be a fairly decent support team for Pino. So I expect him to stay.
Hard to imagine him anywhere else, isn't it, really? We should wrap it up for this week, fellas. But please do become a friend of the Cycling Podcast if you haven't already. Thank you very much to everybody who has signed up for 2016. Your support obviously enables you to listen to 11 exclusive podcasts, but also helps to keep the weekly podcast free. And our first one was released a couple of weeks ago. It was the behind the scenes with Chris Froome in the lab the day that he went and had his physiological testing done. Our second one is being worked on as we speak and will be released imminently. And it is the story of HTC High Road, including an interview with Bob Stapleton, who ran and owned the team. And, you know, very, very fascinating, revealing interview done by Daniel with Bob Stapleton. I think we hear from Brian Holm as well. So it should be an interesting episode, and it'll be out soon. And that's available to friends of the podcast. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com, and it's £10 for 2016, £5 for 2015. So you can still sign up for last year and get all of last year's 11 specials on your mobile device now as well. So that's all for this week, I think. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
So we heard there from Markel Irizar, the Basque sort of domestique at Trek Segafredo. Is that how you pronounce
Segafredo.
It? Segafredo. So we heard there from Markel Irizar, domestique at Trek Segafredo.
Segafredo.
So we heard there from Markel Irizar, domestique at Trek So we heard there from Markel Irizar, domestique at Trek Segafredo, and he's been a teammate.
Take four, that was.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.